This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living. I am Lee Chwee Lin. If three women in your family were diagnosed with breast or ovarian cancer before the age of 60 and eventually died from the illness, would you want to know your risk? And knowing it, what would you do? Angelina Jolie made headlines in 2013 and recently again for discussing genetic testing and the preventive surgeries she's taken to mitigate her risk of ovarian and breast cancer. So joining me to discuss this is, of course, Dr. George Lee, our doctor in the house, consultant neurologist.
Hi, Lee.
Accompanied by Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang from CARIF, because it's all about genetic testing and risk mitigation. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Lee.
Hi, Sue. Dina Sakino, thank you very much for coming. Every time it's Angelina Jolie that brings us together. You know, we went to Cambridge together. We never really get to see each other much, but every time there's a story about Angelina Jolie, then we get to see each other. Isn't it amazing?
I think
we should have more stories about Jolie.
Well, it's not just about Angelina Jolie. It's also about moustaches prostates.
Oh, right, okay. But I think somehow loosely linked to that as well, because obviously, you know, people will say, he's a urologist. What does he know about, breast cancer and ovarian cancer? Obviously, it's loosely linked to prostate cancer as well.
So, coming back then to basics, let's just go back to 2013. Genetic testing was still sort of flying a little bit under the radar, and then Angelina Jolie went public with the test she took. Could you give us a refresher on what that test was?
So basically, there are some families in Malaysia, for example, there are 5,000 women that are diagnosed with breast cancer every year, and approximately 5% of that, so 1 in 20 of that, arises because they inherited a gene from either their mother or father that puts them at a very high risk of breast cancer. So this gene was actually discovered 20 years ago. In 2013 was almost the 20th year celebration for the discovery of this gene. But by and large, most people talk about it behind closed doors in genetics clinics, and it's considered a minority thing. And even in Malaysia, you know, very, very few, less than 1% of the BRCA carriers in Malaysia even know their status. So it's something that is not discussed in public at all. So surprisingly, there are other Hollywood stars that came out and talk about BRCA1 status, such as Christina Applegate earlier on before Angelina Jolie. But none that have the impact like Angelina. I mean, she is a superstar, and everyone looks at her in a particular way, not just because of her status in Hollywood, but also for her work in the United Nations and so on. So it's the sheer bravery of coming out and saying, I have an altered gene, and that puts me at risk of having cancer. And here's the brave action that I took, and I'm going to tell people about it so that we begin to destigmatize cancer.
Yeah,
and
well,
that's wonderful.
I think that's without any doubt, that is a complete admiration that people have for her. Because for somebody so beautiful as she is, number one, openly admit to the public that, you know, she's lost both her breasts, and then also in addition to that actually try to educate people about this mutation of the gene is actually incredibly admirable. The other thing that I think is completely amazing for her is for her to say that you don't even have your breasts to feel like a woman, because obviously, you know, that is this kind of a symbol of feminism, but the thing is that it's beyond that. And then I think without a doubt the impact that she's created is phenomenal. Because there are some statistics under NHS services to say that there's a huge number of increase, 4 times the number of screening of patients after the Jolie's confessions, after that New York Times essay.
Yeah, they've called it the Angelina Jolie effect. And that is partly what I wanted to discuss today. I mean, obviously there are a lot of issues here, including the fact that now she's gone into forced menopause, and, you know, that is just a whole other kettle of fish. But also, looking at this Angelina Jolie effect of more people seeking out this genetic test, as medical professionals, good thing or bad thing? Or is that too simple a question?
I think that's too simple a question in some ways. I think the fact is that genetic testing is not for everybody. So genetic testing does only apply to a small proportion of breast and ovarian cancers, and the overwhelming majority still is sporadic cancers that are linked to factors that we don't know a lot about. So genetic testing is not appropriate for everybody, and we all shouldn't just jump in the bandwagon and say, well, if I have a gene, I'm at risk, and if I don't, I don't have risk. That is something that we should avoid, because because unfortunately where we are with breast cancer at the moment is everyone is at risk. Some are at much higher risk than others, but everyone is at risk.
So is it true to say that the BRCA1 mutation is actually happening about 1 in 400 women in the Western world? Is that the same effect, that the same prevalence we have in Malaysia?
Yeah. So Cancer Research Foundation, together with University of Malaya, have been the main people studying these in Malaysia. And we find that the prevalence among breast cancer patients is almost identical to that in the Caucasian population. But what we find is particularly worrying in Malaysia is Malaysians don't report their family history very well. There's still a lot of stigma around cancer, and therefore young women who are diagnosed think that, oh, no one in my family is has got breast cancer.
So what do you mean by that? It's just like, even if you have a mother who has got breast cancer, you will try to it's not discussed in the family. That's the reason why people don't talk about it.
Yeah. So for example, a couple of the young women that we have seen in our clinics, they have, so one particular young lady, for example, was diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 28. And when she came to us, she said, I have no family history of breast cancer. So we did a genetic test because the features of her cancer suggested that she did have a BRCA1 or 2 mutation. And therefore, we offered genetic testing to her. And after the testing, it turned out that it was true. She did actually have the gene. And only when she discussed it with her father, it was then discovered that actually 3 of her aunties had breast cancer.
Oh.
But she never knew about it.
Oh, right.
So the stigma that surrounds cancer means that people don't know their family history. And because they don't know their family history, they don't come forward for counselling and for more information to understand what their actual risks are. And that's really important. I think more than anything else, the Angelina Jolie effect in Malaysia should be a push for people to talk more openly about cancer. Focus on the fact that more and more women are surviving breast cancer. I think that's the message that should go out there, that Angelina Jolie is testament that even if you had a gene that put you at high risk, you go on and lead a beautiful life with a fantastic husband, 6 kids, and you can continue to do lots and lots of things.
I want to address that point about family history, but first we should get to Jo's question. This is coming via text. She says, my auntie on my father's family died of ovarian cancer at 37 years old. Am I in the high risk category, and what kind of screenings should I do?
I think it depends on the type of... That's a really good question, because as you would know, BRCA1 and BRCA2 is linked to both breast cancer as well as ovarian cancer. And we know that the predictive power for ovarian cancer is actually much higher. So for someone who has a family member with ovarian cancer, if in particular it's a subtype that we call serous high-grade ovarian cancer, then certainly they should come forward and talk to a genetic counsellor to understand more about what is their risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer.
If that particular listener is actually coming forward to go to CARIF and get genetic testing and proven to be positive for mutation for BRCA1, what are her risk of developing breast cancer herself, just like Angelina Jolie? What was her risk, and what will her risk be developing ovarian cancer, and what would her brothers or a son develop prostate cancer?
Right. So for breast cancer, we currently don't actually have estimates in the Asian population. Cancer Research Initiatives Foundation, or CARIF, is doing that research, but we don't actually have accurate estimates in Malaysia at the moment. So we're relying currently on estimates that are built on a Caucasian population, and there's some dangers of using those. But in the Caucasian population, it's estimated that by the age of 70, something like 2/3 of BRCA1 carriers will develop breast cancer.
About 60%?
About 65% of women would develop breast cancer by the time they're age 70.
Okay.
And that's the same for BRCA1 and BRCA2.
So that was Jolie's risk?
Yes, that's okay. Right. So Jolie actually put it at slightly higher because she has stronger family history.
She mentioned that it's about
87%. So this is really quite complex, because we think of it as one gene, one disease, right?
That's
but
right.
The reality is, in some families, together with their other genetic makeup, it actually puts their risk higher. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you have the gene and you have one mother affected by ovarian cancer, your risk is higher than if you have the gene and you have nobody in your family that's affected.
Of course, if you are a smoker or you live very unhealthily, that is a multiplier effect, really.
Okay. Yeah.
What about ovarian cancer?
So for ovarian cancer, it's roughly half of that. So for BRCA1, you have a 40% chance of developing ovarian cancer by the age of 70. You have BRCA2, it's roughly a 15% chance of developing ovarian cancer. And for men, I think that's an excellent question that you have raised, which is, are men at risk? Because men often think, well, if I have breast cancer and ovarian cancer in my family, phew, I'm a man.
This has nothing to do with me.
It has got nothing to do with me. But that actually is not true. So we have contributed the research which has shown that men with BRCA1 mutations are twice as likely to get prostate cancer, and men with BRCA2 mutations are 7 times more likely to get prostate cancer. Mm. And more importantly, the prostate cancer that they get is the aggressive type. So there's the high Gleason score type, which you know for many men with high PSA, you're suspicious, but there's watchful waiting. Mm. But if you're a BRCA2 carrier, then there's no watchful waiting.
Exactly, you need to get it out.
And get it out.
And
yes.
Is it earlier presentation? Do you see it in younger men as opposed to older gentlemen?
Well, it's not a lot younger, so there isn't an age shift towards a younger group. And actually, for the ovarian cancer, our study has shown that there isn't much of an age. There isn't an earlier onset for ovarian cancer among BRCA1 and 2 carriers compared to non-carriers. And this has been consistent with research that's been done in other countries.
Will you see that effect, like you know, prostate cancer? You mentioned that if they have a BRCA1 and 2 mutation, then they're more aggressive. Will, let's say, Jolie developed breast cancer or ovarian cancer, would it be more aggressive form that she would develop it?
I think the data for this is very patchy. So certainly for ovarian cancer, there's no evidence that women like Angelina Jolie, if she was to develop ovarian cancer, there's no evidence that they have a poorer outcome. There's no evidence that they have more aggressive disease, but they develop a different type of disease. Mm-hmm. So what we think of as cancer, you know, it's like, in a sense, it's like Malaysia. You know, we all live in Malaysia, we're all Malaysians, but we're not actually quite the same, right? Some of us are Chinese, some are Malay, some are Indian, some are indigenous people and so on. In the same way, we actually, breast cancers lie in the same geographical location.
It's a spectrum.
But they're not exactly the same disease, yes. So there are some diseases which are triple negative breast cancer, there's ER positive breast cancer, and so on and so forth. So what we know is that BRCA1 carriers are more likely to develop one type of breast cancer, and those types of breast cancer are more aggressive than those that are in other women. But if you compare it with the same type of breast cancer, then there's no evidence that people who have a genetic change have got a worse outcome than the individuals that have no genetic alteration.
I'm speaking today with Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang of CARIF. We are discussing Angelina Jolie's op-ed recently that revealed yet again her health decisions. So we're opening up the phone lines. If you have any questions on genetic screening, if you'd like to answer about whether or not you would want to know your risk, whether or not you would make those same decisions, that number to call is 03-771-09000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. It is our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, joined by Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang of CARIF. They're both here to discuss Angelina Jolie's recent health decision to have a further prophylactic surgery on top of her double mastectomy, which she had in 2013. And she wrote an op-ed about it, and now people are discussing it all over again, and here we are discussing it as well.
Do you think the impact this time round, 2 years down the line, is similar to what the impact we saw in 2013?
You know, I think it's interesting because I felt that this time one message came through stronger, or perhaps it just touched me more, and that was the idea of choice. Because I think she stressed that a lot in the article, the idea that, this was my choice.
But it's my choice.
Yeah, but you should have the choice. The point is that you should know about your health and you should be able to make that choice. I sense, though, that you have different thoughts on this.
No, I'm you know, obviously the only male in this room. I am keen to hear what women think about it. Then I'll give you, in my own view, that what men think about it. Sue, what do you think, you know, this time round, you know, last time, if you Google Jolie mastectomy, I think you will come up with, I don't know, 10,000 hits or something like that. But if you Google, you know, oophorectomy, which was only last week, and then, you know, you only get the Washington Post, you get New York Times, and then didn't quite kind of like hit the headlines. Why do you think that's the case?
I think that's a good thing. I actually think that last time there was too much hysteria, mm-hmm. and the result of the hysteria was that there's a lot of misinformation and misinterpretation of the information. Yeah. Whereas I think I really like the last sentence that Angelina Jolie wrote in her New York Times article, which basically relates to knowing is better than not knowing.
Knowledge is power, she said.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that really is a much more informed, much more a mature article. Because the first article was very emotional, mm-hmm. very, very much one that caused a lot of hysteria. And it was necessary. It created that Angelina Jolie effect, which is impactful.
In fact, I'm glad you mentioned about her last line, because tomorrow, funnily enough, I'm actually doing a TED Talk about the word fear. Because what I wanted to highlight is, as a urologist, how do men and women look at health and look at fear? Because traditionally, we always assume empowerment of somebody is knowledge. You know, if you, like, say, for example, Angelina Jolie, you said that her last line, you said, you can seek advice, learn about the options and make choices that are right for you. Knowledge is power. I think this idea is extremely applicable to women. But I would like to, in my talk tomorrow, what I'm going to argue is that such fear, power in knowledge form doesn't necessarily will influence everyone. Because if you actually tell a man that, you know, by knowing your BRCA genes, you may actually have certain power to decide whether you want to have your prostate off or not, I think that will have a very different impact on men's decisions, which is something that actually I think is a very fascinating way of looking at treatment-seeking behavior in men, which is always a biggest problem that they present late. So it's not necessarily the fear that actually is working all the time. So in my opinion, I think this time round, you know, I asked myself this question about the Jolie effect. Is this a pathological fear of death, or is this sensible preservation of life? And I want Klang Valley to join the conversation to talk about this, because is this really a pathological fear of death? Does it mean that in the future, because the world that we went into Cambridge in 25 years ago is very different from the world today, because now we know genetic mapping, we can do everything to know our risk. However, how much of that can we take to remove in order to preserve our life? Is this sensible, or is this become pathological?
And that number to call is 0377109000. You can also text 0162019000 or tweet at BFM Radio to join in the conversation. We're asking you, does this just represent fear of death, or does this represent a sensible preservation of life? That's a very good phrase. But one thing I did want to ask you both is, we do speak to an awful lot of doctors, you know, in the course of the however many days we are on air doing this program.
6 years.
Yeah. And I do get the sense of different doctors preferring their patients coming in with different levels of information. You have some doctors who say they enjoy seeing their patients come in with printouts, with, you know, having done their reading, coming in and going, okay, so what are my options? And, you know, can I have a laparoscopic surgery? Can I have this and that? And other doctors who still prefer, I think, being the primary source of information, being the Google, as opposed to having patients Googling before them. And with the Angelina Jolie effect, I think you have a lot of people furiously going, you know, double mastectomy, genetic screening. So for both of you, do you prefer, you know, meeting a patient for a consultation, coming in with a dictionary and an encyclopedia and a bunch of pages, or do you prefer a patient coming in and just asking you questions?
I think from a public health perspective, I would really like to have greater understanding and knowledge in the population. Unfortunately, this kind of information only reaches probably 10% of the Malaysian population. We're not reaching the bulk of the population for whom we could make a really big difference in prevention of cancer, in being able to empower people to take that knowledge is power. We are not there. But for the individuals who are very well informed, fear is a massive motivator. You know, it will, it's a really hard thing. I mean, particularly for a charity like Cancer Research Initiatives Foundation. I mean, what we're trying to do is we're trying to make the big C a little C, because we believe very much that if we can prevent one third of cancers, one half of cancers, we should absolutely be doing that. But to do that, we need to remove fear so that we can start talking about cancer in a sensible way. But there lies the dilemma, because when you get rid of the fear, You get rid of the motivator.
That's right.
And then what do you do? How do you engage?
How to strike that balance, you know, is essentially a dilemma of what a clinician's healthcare provider always worry about. Because, like, the question to me is that when I get a huge encyclopedia or printout, at the end of the day, the recipient or the person who the sufferers actually have some degree of background knowledge and logics behind their minds. However, to digest all that information, there are always confusion. That's why I agree with Sue earlier on that whenever the first wave of the Jolie effect that came in and it created a lot of problems because everybody have a printout and every has an opinion. However, I mean, we have to understand there's a huge area of this big jigsaw puzzle that we don't really know. So it's difficult to actually answer all the questions. However, sometimes that fear might tip the balance to be overzealous and over-treating. And then that is sometimes worrying about creating this pathological fear of death.
We have a question here from Vijaya. So, Dr. Teo, would you advise women who have a family history of breast cancer to go for tests to determine if there is a presence of the BRCA1 gene in them, besides, of course, going for mammograms?
Absolutely. So I think that I wouldn't advocate a test because a patient needs to make a decision for themselves whether a genetic test is appropriate for them or not. But I think knowledge is power. So I think that all women who have either a family history of breast or ovarian cancer should find out more. We have a research study that's ongoing at the moment that's provided free genetic counselling to anyone who is interested. So they can call Carif at 5. I'll give you the number at the end of the session, but they can call us and just get more information.
Again, if you have any questions for either Dr. George or Dr. Teo, you can call us at 03-77109000. The number to text is 016-201-9000. You can also tweet at BFM Radio. We are also asking you, with these sort of preventive surgeries, with all this knowledge is power talk, you know, does this represent a pathological fear of death or a sensible preservation of life? Would you do the same? If you had access to what Angelina Jolie had, we're waiting to hear from you.
Good question. Would you do the same, Lynn?
I would.
You would?
I would.
You would do exactly what the Jolie decisions making.
I would, but you know, I did have a question here, and I suppose now's as good a time as any.
Yeah.
But I think it changes if you haven't yet had children. And you want to have children, then that changes.
That becomes a big dilemma.
I think so, because I would, but I would wait till I've had my children.
And in Malaysia, actually, most women are very worried about the age at which they have genetic counselling and testing. Mm. Because if you have a mother who is, let's say, in her 40s, who had breast cancer, you know, her sister had breast cancer also in her 40s, and then you're in your 20s, right? You haven't, maybe you have a boyfriend.
Good point.
Not yet steady
That's
yet.
That's right.
And you're wondering, well, if I have a genetic test, now, does it do me for life? Am I not going to, you know, be able to get married and so on? And these are real challenges.
Well, actually, they're challenges for you to your healthcare insurance and everything like that, because the knowledge is power, but the knowledge can also be a threat to a lot of your opportunities.
Yeah. But I think the really good thing, let's focus on the positives. The positives is even for someone who has a BRCA1 and 2 mutation, the average age for breast cancer, even if it was to occur, is about 41, 42. Mm. So there's ample time for you to have
to make that decision.
And to make that decision. Don't rush into it.
But is
that's not something that you need to rush into.
But that's breast cancer. Is it the same for ovarian cancer?
The average age for ovarian cancer in our study is about 45.
So it's even later.
Yes.
Yeah. Because Jolie was 39, right?
Yeah.
And then because she's well within the kind of comfort zone area.
Yes.
Do you actually have any limit of someone coming forward for genetic testing? I mean, would you, if I bring my kids, you know, would you do that? Because the gene will not change, right?
Yeah. We don't agree in, we do not test children, and that's because we believe that it's not the parent's decision, it should be the child's decision. So it should be every individual's right to decide for themselves whether they want to know the status or not. It is very different if you're considering genetic testing for a disease that affects a child, then obviously the parent needs to make a decision. But if it's an adult onset disease, which is what breast cancer and ovarian cancers then there's no justification to test a child without them really knowing. There's something in the UK called Gillick competence.
Oh, right.
And very much you need to be able to take your own decisions. And for BRCA1 and 2 testing, that's a decision that you need to make. Having said that, increasingly women are asking, can I choose in vitro fertilization, for example, and do pre-implantation genetic testing so that in a child, if I know I'm a carrier, I pick the 1 in 2 embryos that don't have the alteration.
Wow.
And I have a child on that way.
That gets into another can of kind of, you know, Pandora's kind of like, you know, a dilemma that we can discuss.
I think so. But on that note about Angelina Jolie being 39 now, that leads back to that issue of family history that I wanted to discuss earlier, because she points out that her mother was diagnosed, I think, at 49, and you're supposed to kind of look at that 10-year bracket. And so when it comes to family history and it being an incomplete family history, what do I need to tell you when it comes to that? Because I might, for example, know that my aunt had ovarian cancer, my mother had ovarian cancer, my uncle has prostate cancer, but I might not know when they were diagnosed, right? I might know that perhaps they had it, they might have died of it, but do I need to also tell you that when they were diagnosed, what kind of cancer it was? Because that's information I might not have access to.
You know, this is the type of information for which countries that have a cancer registry do much better. So all of the Scandinavian countries, for example, have a cancer registry that all of these can be verified. And because they have identity cards, all of that can be verified. You don't have to rely on your self-report, your memory and your accessibility to the rest of your family. Because, the amount of information that you have will rely on how close you are with your family and whether you only meet them over a Yisang or whether over Chinese New Year effectively or over a Hari Raya, or do you actually meet them on a fairly regular basis so that you're intimately aware of any medical conditions that might take place in the family. Unfortunately, in Malaysia, the National Cancer Registry doesn't work in that way, and therefore that resource is not available to us. So that poses huge challenges throughout Asia that family history is not accurately reported. Because family history is not accurately reported, we are now working on a model that relies on just having your immediate family history, and then if you are at higher risk, what we're hoping to do is to develop a test that is so low cost that you don't have to think about it so much. Because previously, a test would have cost anywhere from 14,000 to 15,000 ringgit, you know, $5,000 US or some $4,000 or $5,000 US, something like that. Whereas we are using next generation sequencing technology, and we are hoping that by the end of this year, we'll be able to offer the test at somewhere between 300 to 500 ringgit per patient. In which case, the threshold for considering testing after you've been appropriately counseled, hopefully will come down.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, being the data in Malaysia is grossly insufficient, because a few days ago I was asked to write an article about prostate cancer prevalence in Malaysia, and you know, I found out that our registry had voluntary kind of like reporting system from the clinicians, and then we only have something like 500 prostate cancer in 1 year in 2006. I was going like, you know, this 500 cases can be in one centre, and how can that be the case?
I have seen all of them.
It's like, you know, it's grossly, grossly underreporting. And that is something that many, many places, even in the UK, when it comes to voluntary reporting, will face huge challenges, because those are very important data to look at trends.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, George. You know, for breast cancer, if you follow the National Cancer Registry, then we are the only country in the region that has seen a decrease in incidence of breast cancer. Right. And that just cannot be.
Because on the field, on the front line, you know, that is not reflective.
Yeah.
We do have a contribution here from Joe again, who says, to me, it's sensible preservation of life and being responsible rather than being an ostrich hiding its head in the sand. Everyone dies once, but you don't need to die early because of ignorance.
Okay, Joe, the next question is, how many more do you test in order to preserve life? Which will be something that we look forward to hearing from you from your text message.
Well, okay, so we're going to take a break right now for the market update. But when we come back, we're still looking forward to hearing from you. Is it a pathological fear of death? Is it a sensible preservation of life? And given the chance, given the option, would you opt to do the same thing as Angelina Jolie did? The number to call is 03-77-109-000. You can also join in via text. That number is 016-201-9000. You can also tweet at BFM Radio. Hello, you are still listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, and Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang of CARIF. We are discussing Angelina Jolie, preventive surgery, genetic risks, pathological fear of death. It's all wrapped up into one not so neat but very interesting bundle. If you'd like to join in the conversation, that number to call is 03-7710-9000. You can also text 01-6201-9000 or tweet at BFM Radio. So we've been talking a lot about choice and a lot about kind of making that decision to take an active part in your health. I'm having enough information. Now, one interesting thing that I found was she talked about how much contact she was having with her doctors, you know, while trying to come up with this decision about whether or not to do this thing. And do most of us have that kind of access, though? I mean, she is really in quite a privileged stratosphere in terms of having her husband fly home from France immediately upon receiving this diagnosis. And she acknowledges her luck, but for most
of us... having a husband who can buy her some lovely undergarments that cost about $40,000 or something.
Well, I mean, she is living the life. There's no denying that. And she has access to... I can't even begin to comprehend how many doctors,
exactly,
you know. And so is
but
it the same?
I mean, in a research setting, presumably, you know, a patient will have that sort of access to research in CARIF, really, you know, the constant, because those informations are very important for them to get reassurance and things like that. Would they have that sort of access to information?
So access in Malaysia to genetic counselling is fairly limited at the moment. So as part of a research study, we've been providing free genetic counselling and genetic testing to individuals that have any family history or any features that are suggestive that they may be carriers of BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations. And this is for breast cancer patients as well as ovarian cancer patients. So for anyone who is interested, they can come to our centre or give us a call on 03-5639-1874, and we'll repeat the telephone number at the end of the show. But this service is available to anyone who wants to have access to services.
It's almost as good as the Hollywood's kind of version.
I wouldn't say so, because I think the Hollywood version involves individuals who have clinicians that are very well versed with when to do prophylactic mastectomies and be able to do complicated nipple sparing surgeries, for example. That is not a cheap
exactly,
and not something that's widely available. And then thankfully for the oophorectomy, which is the removal of the ovaries, because women with BRCA1 and 2 mutations are at high risk of ovarian cancer, that is actually a very straightforward
procedure that is being carried out every day in Osaka.
Absolutely. And the key thing here is that it's laparoscopic, which basically means that you can always do it as a day surgery and go home the same day. So the surgery itself is straightforward, but the consequences of the surgery in putting you to early menopause, and there are side effects. Let's not run away from the fact that there are, you know, nothing in life, unfortunately, comes without any strings.
That's exactly what I wanted to talk about, because what struck me again while reading this was, I mean, yes, the double mastectomy,
You don't lose your life. Your configurations might alter, but the thing is that it will have no significant impact on your health for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's very dramatic, but you know, losing your ovaries, that is really just a whole other situation. And you know, Professor, you mentioned you talked quite a bit about how genetic tests are really, it's a case-by-case basis, right? The patient themselves have to decide when it's right for them. So similarly, what factors need to go into deciding whether or not the surgery is right for the patient in terms of an oophorectomy?
I think oftentimes the history is very similar to Angelina. So if you look at Angelina, she probably has been screening her ovaries and her breast for some time.
And which essentially is ultrasound and blood tests.
Yes, ultrasound, mammograms, blood tests, MRIs for the breast if you're at a younger age. But after several of these, you might find something. You know, you might find something that it creates this huge panic because you're going for screening potentially every 3 months, potentially every 6 months.
And then suddenly the tumour markers raise, which like is what happened here.
Absolutely. And that usually, it's that experience and having experience of going through, is it cancer this time? It's not. Oh, it's not. But then you come back and it's again the same. Is it a cancer this time? It's not. So it's that experience of coming back again and again with a screening. particularly for ovarian cancer, when we know that the screening tools don't work so well, then at some point, many women, in our study, we find that about 50% of women choose to have an oophorectomy. So, and only 5% have chosen to have a mastectomy. So it's basically saying that oophorectomies are more acceptable to women in this in our setting. And the reason, I think, is because the surgery is less invasive.
Is it also because of the deadliness of the cancer?
Yes. Yeah, and also because we know that there is no good way of screening for ovarian cancer, and the ovarian cancer is more lethal, if you like, compared to breast cancer.
And we do have a phone call from LTY. Good afternoon, LTY.
Good afternoon, LTY. Lynn. How are you, Lynn?
I'm well. How are you, LTY? Okay.
Good afternoon, Dr. George.
Good afternoon.
Professor Teo, how are you all?
Okay. We're very good.
Yeah.
We thought we'd miss you because it's Qingming and you're not in town.
Hey, I'm asking on behalf of my wife, all right? She's now 66 years old. My question is this. What is the possibility of breast or ovarian or cervical cancer? And my second question is this. From your research experience, is there any statistic with respect to the age senescence, say between 60 to 85? Can you tell us something about this age group? Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, LTY.
Hi, LTY. For the cancers that you have mentioned, your wife is at highest risk of breast cancer because that's the most common cancer among women. Uh-huh. But it then depends on whether she has any family members that have been affected by either breast or ovarian cancer.
No, as far as I know, no. But I'm a bit concerned about sporadic mutation, right? Am I right, Professor Teo?
Yes.
It can happen anytime, right?
Yeah.
Even without BRCA1, BRCA2, you still have from other source of gene, right? Mutation, other genes.
You are absolutely right. So basically, for a woman who is about 66 years old, then she would roughly have about a 2 to 4% chance of developing breast cancer in the next 10 years. So for someone in that age group, we would very strongly recommend that she has a mammogram, probably once every 2 years. But when you take the first mammogram, your radiologist will be able to advise you what the frequency of the next mammogram would be.
Okay, what is the survival rate?
For breast cancer? Well, if you are able to detect stage 1 breast cancer, we're talking about 95, 98% or 99% survival over 10 years.
10 years.
So it's a very good survival if it's a small cancer that is detected. Mm. For ovarian cancer, unfortunately, the risk is actually much lower. So the next 10 years, her risk is about 1% risk of developing ovarian cancer. There's no good screening tool for ovarian cancer, so you just need to watch out for the signs and symptoms, unfortunately.
Yes.
And then for the last one, was it cervical cancer that you were asking? For cervical cancer, then we would strongly recommend that she has a pap smear, and that pap smear depends on whether the last pap smear that she had was abnormal or it was normal, but she should have a pap smear. Do you know when was the last time she had a pap smear?
So far, until now, she hasn't done any.
All right. LTY, I think you need to get on your bike next week. All right. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you,
LTY. And we also have Madam Lau via SMS who says, precisely, she is the privileged lot. She, I think, here referring to Angelina Jolie as opposed to LTY's wife. How many of the general public can do these kinds of tests? She's simply overzealous about prevention. She should fight the BRCA1 gene with diet and exercise and a change of lifestyle. How many body parts does she want to remove before she is totally
this
free
is
of
exactly
this?
What my wife said.
Unfortunately, Trillin, it's not possible.
It's not possible to fight the genes, right?
It is not possible. For individuals that have a genetic alteration like BRCA1 and BRCA2, there has been nothing, and we have tested it. So researchers all over the world are looking for alternatives to the prophylactic surgeries, and there is nothing at the moment that works. So it doesn't matter how many children...
No medication, no healthy lifestyle. It is just if the cause of the mutation, it induces some sort of neoplasia, it will happen.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important point to drive home, which is that for cancers such as lung cancer and colorectal cancer, you can say that you can eliminate 70% of it with healthy lifestyle. If, you know, not having any tobacco, not having any alcohol, and not having so much red meat, you can get rid of lung cancer as well as colorectal cancer. But for breast cancer, even if all women in the world had a healthy lifestyle and we all became vegetarians and drank no alcohol and exercised 3 times a week, at most, we would reduce breast cancer incidence by 10%.
Oh.
At most. And that's involving all women in the world.
Collectively.
Collectively. Yeah. So the reality is,
I think you single-handedly just induced an outflow of people going out there and celebrate their lives.
Alternatively, you have individuals that, I think we need to change our perception of breast cancer. You know, we're very used to lung disease, and we say, okay, we're going to test for cholesterol, and we've got high cholesterol, we pop a statin, right? I actually think that this is where we're going to go with breast cancer. You should go for a mammogram. And if you have a high mammographic density, then maybe you're at higher risk and you ought to be taking some interventions, perhaps tamoxifen for 6 months or a year, a low-dose chemotherapy for a low, and that will then get rid of any cancer cells and you're going to be cancer-free for the next 30 years.
Mm.
That is the type of thing that we're going to be investing our research money on, trying to work out how it is that on the public health scale, we begin to tackle prevention of breast cancer.
Mm.
Although I did feel that this text raised one good point very much, which is that she isn't free of cancer risk though, right? I mean, just because she has had these surgeries done doesn't mean she's removed her risk 100%.
But the amount of reduction is amazing. So if we think about it, you are talking about a 95% reduction in risk of breast cancer because she's had prophylactic mastectomy. So instead of having a 65% chance of developing breast cancer, it's now down to roughly 0.2 or 0.1%,
right,
something like that. So it's a huge decrease. Instead of having a 40% risk of developing ovarian cancer, it's now at about 0.4% or 1% risk of developing ovarian cancer. It's a huge difference.
Yep.
If any dietary change could induce that, we don't know about it. And it's not for the want of trying.
Another question here from Kay, who says, my dad had a sarcoma which led to lung cancer. What kind of risk do I carry? Is this a question that we can answer?
Sarcoma, I think that's a kind of like muscle induced, cancer. And in and lung cancer, I think they're not related. However, we're obviously not qualified to verify that. But, I don't think they're related to BRCA gene in any way, right?
I think it raises a very important issue, which is that why, when you have a genetic alteration like BRCA1, you only get breast and ovarian cancer. Why not any other cancers? You know, if this gene is involved in repairing DNA damage, then why do you get only these types? Surprisingly, there are certain cells which are present in the breast and present. Actually, ovarian cancer, we think, arises in the fallopian tubes. You know, the bits that are tied up in tubal ligations so that you don't get pregnant. It's the fallopian tube that connects the ovaries to the cervix. And that part actually have got similar cells that are in the breast. So these two cell types seem to be more likely to develop cancer in individuals that have BRCA1. For sarcomas, there may be a link to other genes. So we think that different genes are involved in different types of cancers. And if you have a sarcoma, there's no evidence to suggest that you're at higher risk of breast and ovarian cancer, but it may link to be a different syndrome. And certainly there's lots of information about that.
And with the gene, with the BRCA1 and 2 gene being discovered 20 years ago, and with this test being developed, and hopefully with prices coming down and availability and access being increased, what stands in the way? Is it accurate to say that each new gene is really each new thing? You know, every new gene will have its own test. You cannot just transform one platform into another.
Actually, we think that there are only 4 what we call high penetrance genes. That means there are only 4 genes that when you inherit them, it will give you a very high risk of breast and ovarian cancer, just the same way as BRCA1 and BRCA2 does. So BRCA1, BRCA2, P53 and PARP-B2. And our panel will have all 4 genes included. All of the other genes are likely to be what we call moderate penetrance. So in some individuals, they get cancer, in some individuals, they don't, but they are slightly elevated risk. This is where we get into really tough ground. So as part of our research, we've already uncovered about 150 genetic loci that cause an increased risk to breast cancer. But that increased risk to breast cancer, instead of having a 5% risk, maybe approximately an 8% risk. What do you do with 8%? Do you have a mastectomy? The answer is no, I don't think so. I would never advise anyone to have a mastectomy. Do you go for more screening? Probably yes. But maybe that's where we need to get to. You know, I think that what our research is showing us is that we shouldn't all be treating women all the same. We shouldn't tell all women, you all wear medium-sized T-shirts. That's not the case. Maybe what we should be doing is, if you have got dense mammograms, if you have higher risk of breast cancer because of family history, maybe you need screening from the age of 35 and you need a high dose of green tea or a high dose of chemo prevention for 6 months, and then you're sorted in terms of preventing breast cancer. But for the rest, maybe you're not at high risk and you only need one screen every 5 years from the age of 50. Of course, I'm dreaming at the moment. This is not something that's reality at the moment.
This is a utopia.
This is a utopia that we're working towards in our research programs.
Do you find that genetic screening, I mean, in your experience, based on the people who come through the center, based on the people you meet, do you find that genetic screening gives a certain measure of peace of mind in the long run? Because I think therein lies one of the central issues, right? Because some people just don't want to live with this hanging over their heads, while other people feel that, you know, to go for the screenings, to know their risk, allows them some measure of control.
Trillian, you're absolutely right. For some, there's a dichotomy. So in some individuals, knowledge is power, just like Angelina Jolie, and they use that information to provide closure. Yeah. To provide closure, it gives them empowerment. For other individuals, unfortunately, they're in a situation where they may not be able to cope with that information, which is why genetic counselling is absolutely pivotal. Because once you know something, you cannot unknow it. You cannot say, I don't know
and,
it.
And also, once you know something, it doesn't just impact you, impact the rest of your family
as well.
So that is the, you know, that's the most important part. And that amazes me, because one of the questions I want to ask you is, like, you know, you are CEO for CARIF. Obviously, you deal a lot with benchwork research for Malaysian population and look at Eastern population, and also you have to deal with genetic counselling as well, because dealing with the subjects who are coming forward for research purposes, you need to actually handle their emotions, psychological and things like that. And also on top of that, you still have to raise funds, because this is clearly a, you know, non-profit organisation. How do you do it? It's like, you know, this is almost you know, a task in the scale of kind of like impossibility.
It's a Herculean task, I think.
Not at all. I have a fantastic team. And I think one of the fantastic things about Malaysia is, if you are doing the right thing, people do come forward and support it. Mm. But let's not kid ourselves. Genetic testing, doing research, is really expensive.
Costs money. And a lot of money.
A lot of money. And we could do with more support. I think it'll be really nice for people who come to know about us, support the work that we do. I know that there are a lot of charities out there that are that have more immediate concerns, you know, orphanages and so on. But invest in us, because it's an investment into the future. We are doing what we can, hopefully, to provide services now, to deal with high-risk patients now, but also to provide hope that we can make a change. So the essence of what drives us in CARIF is hope lives here. We sincerely believe that through the work that we can do, then we can hopefully be able to ensure that more patients survive, more patients are empowered, and more patients are able to prevent cancer.
Yeah, I'm sure in apart from finance and resource opportunities and things, there are other ways that the public can help CARIF as well, right?
Absolutely. So we have many ways in which they can come and help us reduce fear of cancer. So recently we've developed this really cool set of lemons that are showing the signs and symptoms of breast cancer. So we find that, you know, when you have mannequins and little silicone models of a breast, nobody wants to touch them because it's scary. If you're trying to give out a leaflet of breast cancer, nobody wants to know about breast cancer. But we devised this little tool that involves lemons that are silicone, and they actually look like either indentation that is like an indented nipple, or fluid extruding from the lemon, which looks a little bit like what you would see in a nipple, which is really quite cool.
Very helpful for patients.
Very helpful
as well.
And we're looking for individuals to come forward and help us take the message out there. Mm. Help us reduce the fear of cancer.
Okay, and just to wrap up yet again, if people are interested in genetic counselling, genetic testing, or just finding out what their risks are and they just want to talk to somebody, how can they reach you?
So they can certainly reach us on by telephone. We're based at Sime Darby Medical Centre. We're actually a non-profit organisation located in the hospital. We're not part of the hospital. The telephone number is 03-5639-1874, or log on to our website. It is www.carif.com.my.
Thank you both so much for joining me today. I have been speaking to Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang of CARIF. We've been discussing just all sorts of things.
But I want to know, okay, Lynn, what's your final thought? Pathological fear of death or sensible preservation of life?
Sensible preservation of life. She has children. She should do what she can to live however long and however beautifully she wants
to. I agree with you.
You've been listening to The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.